Good evening. So if you don't have any questions, it'll be a short evening.
Would you please elaborate on the two-hour study of the writings?
Okay, I think I said a couple of hours, and I haven't seen any elaboration of Shoghi Effendi on this question. Obviously has to be taken in the context of what one is able to do with their lives. Why I mention it is that it just suggests to us that we probably don't give enough time for study of the writings. And that the reading of a few verses in the morning and the evening, Baha'u'llah says the purpose of that is to give wings to the soul, flight to the soul, that it soars. So that's an inspirational kind of experience. But it can hardly constitute the requirement and obligation to study thoroughly and painstakingly the literature of the faith that Shoghi Effendi mentions elsewhere, because it doesn't provide the time. So I don't know whether if you can manage to do the painstaking study in 2 hours, that's fine. Otherwise, you have to think of something else. She's going to ask about that again. And how many hours then should it be? This gentleman, I think you were next. Day.
If you could provide some guidance to families, parents, and the influence of media and entertainment on bringing up Baha'i children and junior youth.
Well, that's a challenge. I think that parents have to kind of think about this whole thing themselves and decide what they can do, because it's pretty hard after you let the thing loose to bring it back in again without looking like you're dreadfully tyrannical or something. And I don't know, I see some families, I notice they have a certain limited range of things that their children, certainly before their junior youth, I mean, we're coming back to when they're children, the kind of things that they can watch. And some don't allow television at all, that everything is reading-based. But it depends what kind of a circumstance you're in, what the other Baha'i children in the community are experiencing. There's so many different things that have a bearing on that I think it's a pretty difficult question to give rules, suggestions. Suggestions is there are grave dangers in the media and the music and the things that kids plug in their ears for hours and hours on end. But how to deal with it, I'm not sure. We've been kind of isolated from communities and children's classes in the Holy Land and dealing with other, dare I say, more adult issues, but that's certainly an adult issue, but I mean, we haven't had to talk too much about that. I wish I could offer you more, but maybe there are people here, they've heard you ask the question, they will come and tell you, look, we did this in our family, it was successful, please take advantage of that. Somebody's going to have to say who's next, because I think you're next, and right, we'll come over here for one.
I was wondering if you could share some more recollections of the experiences of the hands of the
cause. Sure, can just do that. I was fortunate during the World Crusade, I was living in a very isolated place in Nicaragua on the Atlantic side, the Caribbean side of Nicaragua, and in a sleepy little town of 10,000 that had suffered the ravages of a banana blight. So that the people were really unemployed and sitting on the curbs, and it was a sad kind of a place. And yet being in that isolation, it attracted several hands of the cause of God that visited, who were traveling. The hands in the crusade were trying as much as they could, all of them, to move around. And so I believe, let's see, the first hand of the cause that I received there as a visitor was Dr. Ugo Giacchieri. Dr. Giacchieri was an amazing, amazing man. Florence Mayberry told me later when I was in Haifa, she said when she was at the table of the Guardian, he began speaking about Ugo. And she said he praised Ugo. And then he said, Ugo is 1,000 men. This is a phrase they have in Persian, very appropriate for Ugo Giacchieri. Now, when the Guardian named the International Baha'i Council, He named Ugo Giocarri as a member at large of that body. And then he became, of course, he was a hand of the cause after that. So he was in close contact with the Guardian. He was so wonderful man. And then Florence said, then the Guardian said, and he's a saint, almost a saint. Still alive, you know. That's a mystery of this world. You can be saintly and then not be after a while. So, but certainly he was a very saintly man, beautiful, marvelous man. How many of you have seen Dr. Giocarri in your life? Because he was in California for a time. Oh, a lot of you. That's wonderful. So you must have reminiscences, wonderful reminiscences. But to have him to myself there in Nicaragua, and that's in this remote area for 3 days, I arranged meetings and advertised for the public to come. You know, I was living alone. It was in a big house. And about 40 people came to hear Dr. Giocarri talk about the Guardian. Actually, I wanted to hear about the Guardian, so I made that the subject. You know? I don't know what the people thought, but they certainly became so reverent and so impressed with the extolling of the Guardian's qualities by Dr. Giocarri, who spoke with such love, so tenderly of his relationship with Shoghi Effendi. And he told me, oh, he said, if I could only tell you, and this is the Italian side of it, oh, if I could only tell you how much the Guardian loved me. Now, you have to interpret that, and you have to say, if I could only tell you how much love the Guardian poured onto me, expressed to me, because that's really was the situation. And then he glanced at his briefcase. He had a briefcase with the initials S-E-R on it, and he asked me what that was, if I knew what that was. I said, it didn't occur to me immediately. Shoghi Effendi Rabbani, it was one of the Guardian's briefcases that he'd been given by the Guardian. That kind of, yes, that's what I And I think he really touched the hearts of the people talking about the greatness of this man, Shoghi Effendi, they'd never heard of before. And he talked about his artistic abilities and the working of the shrines. You know, as you know, he contributed sufficiently to the shrine that the Guardian named one of the doors of the shrine after him. So he has that eternal, really imperishable honor along with the previous ones. I'm thinking so much of that because a number of the young people we knew have been working on this project as masons and helping to restore the character of the building and also as the tile layers of all the new 12,000 tiles on the dome. What an honor they have, and how they will be surely blessed all their lives through having participated in this, literally on our behalf, on behalf of all of us. And I'm sure Dr. Giocarri was pleased that so many young people, because there were older workers in the original building, and here we had a lot of young people that learned special skills to be able to fix the carvings and do all the things that they did. So that was the first visitor. And then the next one was Inakolinga. Inakolinga had come for the conventions, the inaugural conventions of the National Assemblies of Cuba and Panama, sent by the Hands in the Holy Land. They all had arranged where the different hands would go for these new NSAs. We had four regional NSAs previously in Latin America that the Guardian had called for their establishment in 1957. They'd been formed, and he had a chance to write one major message to each of them before he passed away the following November. So Mr. Linga, then he came up the Central American coast and visited country by country. And he came over to, in Nicaragua, he came over to the east coast where I was. There was a rainforest. The country was, most of all, the civilized country was over on the Pacific side. And there was a road, which if you look at the size of Central America, you wouldn't imagine that you needed a day and a half to go overland to where I was living. But there was a huge rainforest there, and there were rivers with waterfalls and rapids and things. And so the riverboats could come so far, then you had to go by canoe, then you had to march through the mud, then you had to catch a bus and these secondary roads, and finally you got to the capital. So most people flew, and they were old DC-3s that you flew on, and then you conveniently landed in a mud puddle at the other end. So these dear hands of the cause would get out with the mud on the ground and walk around. And I remember Dr. Jacare, he was so informed, it struck me, his knowledge of, I mean, he was a chemist, but he was also quite informed about plants and trees and everything. And he was identifying all these things on the road as we drove in this muddy little track to get into town. I was so seeing him talk about that and the potential industries that he saw for the area and all these things. I was thinking, what a omnibus, what a terrific man he was, like seeing so many things with the same eyes that I'm looking at things and not seeing any of that. And he had a certain way he would gesture. He spoke, he oftentimes held his fan very flat, moved his thumb on the side. Well, I found after he left, I was walking around acting like him for about 3 days. Just the impression that he had, I wanted to be like that, you know. I was maybe 23 at that time, I don't know. Wonderful Dr. Jacare, and he gave lots of advice, and then he went on. I'll get back to Inokalinga again. But Dr. Jacare, well, you think he went on to Honduras? You met him there in Honduras. Marilyn was pioneering. We weren't married yet. She was in the next country north in, with her mother and serving there and studying. And so she met him there, and Ruth Yancey Pringle was also there. She later became a counselor in Central America and so on. So we all had some exposure to him. Dr. Jacare said he liked Bluefields, where he was sleeping a lot better than where he slept in Costa Rica, because there were too many rats in the room. If you could see the dignity of this man, he's nobility from Sicily. You know, he was from a family of counts, and he just had a lot of polish. And sleeping on beds that were too short for him and with rats in the room, he had his sacrifices. And yet he was a good sport about it all. I don't know what we fed him. I can't imagine. Anyway, Italians like their food, you know. I mean, it's part of the business. Anyway, spaghetti, yeah. I don't know if we had spaghetti. Marilyn and I celebrated our first anniversary. We celebrated. We bought one hot Pepsi Cola and split it between us. And that cost a dollar. It was a great indulgence at the time, I can assure you. So they give you some picture of this. People would say, you know, wash your lettuce before you eat it. Be careful, you know, so you don't get sick. But there wasn't any lettuce. And they said, be careful when you're showering that the water doesn't go in your mouth. Very helpful advice. I was bathing in a swimming hole in the back of the city that was full of mud and everything. Anyway, it was a different situation from what people could imagine. Not much in the way of plumbing and such facilities. When we got married, we lived in a little shack that was made out of rough timbers and up off the ground about 3 feet. And it was about 100 yards to walk to a water faucet where we could get water to bring to the house. And another certain kind of a distance to walk out over a parapet to an outhouse over the lagoon. It sounds so romantic. There's these wonderful coconut trees, and you know, if you see a photograph, you say, "My, what an idyllic place to go for a honeymoon!" You know, and it was different when you had to walk on this parapet out to the outhouse. And there were also droves of pigs all over the place, and they used to come under the house at night and rub their backs on the floor, the bottom of the floorboards, you know, and the whole house would vibrate. And then they felt perfectly fine, so they relaxed and relieved themselves. And that would all... There were no screens in the house. There were no windows in the house. There were shutters we opened, and a nice breeze would come in, except when the pigs were at that side of the house. Marilyn had been in a very nice school in Tegucigalpa and had decided against, I don't know, I think she must have decided this by prayer to marry me, because she certainly had her adventures after we came here. You can ask about it. There were lots of mosquitoes. We had a mosquito net, which protected us from the mosquitoes, as long as you didn't put your arm or your leg against the edge of the mosquito net, because then they would bite you through that. But we had some very persistent rats that kept gnawing and breaking the cords and trying to pull the cords for nests. So then the mosquito net would fall down in the middle of the night, and you had to get out and try to tie it again and hold it up and so on. It was an interesting place. When it was decided we could pioneer to a town further north, we jumped at the opportunity. Well, that was another adventure. Anyway, Mr. Olinga came, and he also had wonderful meetings. I mean, coming from Africa, there was a large black population in Bluefields. The majority of people were English-speaking, black Caribbean stock, descendants of the Africans. We went also to some places that had Indians mixed with black Africans. So we took Mr. Olinga up through these jungle canals by boat and went to a village where he dedicated a Baha'i center among the Mosquito Indians. It was very, very nice. It was the first. It's a quaint little place called Raidipura, which means over the grave. And the first Mosquito Indians of the coast became Baha'is there. Some wonderful stories related to that. And he gave some beautiful talks there, and then he came back to the city, and he spoke also at the Baha'i Center, what was my home, really, but served as a Baha'i Center. And we had huge crowds of people come and listen to him. And that was my first experience with him. He went on to Honduras, and Marilyn met him there, and she was asked to travel with him as a translator of his talks from English to Spanish. So she had a number of days with him in very interesting situations and in some of those communities where the African element dominated the Indian element. So you had, what were the names of those people? Like Carib Indians, Caribes, and the Garifunas, yeah. And you can ask her, she can tell you wonderful stories about what happened there. Obviously, we both knew him quite well and met him in later years. He came to South America on a visit, and by that time I was a counselor in South America and was able to travel with him for nearly, 3 months, I think it was. We went all over Argentina. I met him in Brazil and at Foz do Iguazu, and then we came into Paraguay and Argentina, and from there we went to Chile, and then we went to Bolivia and Peru and Ecuador and Colombia, and that was the end of my zone. So I said, I have to say goodbye. And saw him in so many different settings, and he always had the most wonderful talks to give. And whenever he gave a public talk, sometimes on the radio or otherwise, I would say, oh, this talk is perfectly organized like Abdu'l-Bahá. I think this really, he's memorized the talk of Abdu'l-Bahá, and he's giving that. So I'd take some notes to see if I could find the talk later. I could never find those talks. And in the course of being with him, he would talk about his pilgrimage, his unique pilgrimage to Shoghi Effendi. He was the Knight of Baha'u'llah for Cameroon, having come from the original conversions in Uganda. Very shortly after, just within a year or two after they became Baha'is, Shoghi Effendi called on the Africans of the Teso tribe and of that area to go out and open the West African countries to the faith. People that never traveled hardly to the capital of their land were suddenly moving across the continent. Amazing. When Shoghi Effendi named Enoch Olinga Hand of the Cause, he talked about having named Hands of the Cause from the Christian, Muslim, and pagan backgrounds. He said, pagan, that was me. He knew that he was the only one he could be. But he says, my father was a Christian missionary. But it was enough, close enough still to the pagan background that Shoghi Effendi mentions it. So he took pride in that also. Now, Mr. Olinga had a way of, when he was speaking with the Baha'is, he would speak on spiritual matters. if you examine, and this is following the tradition of Abdu'l-Bahá, if you examine Abdu'l-Bahá's talks in the promulgation of universal peace, and of course already in Paris talks, but he was talking again mostly to believers when he in the Paris talks. And in the United States, when he's gathered with believers, he speaks on one kind of subject. And when he's gathered with the public, he speaks on another. He speaks more broadly in a more universal way. But when he's with the Baha'is, he starts talking about the necessity of efforts and spirituality and attaining the spirit of faith and so many wonderful counsels. And when you read Three Issue Distinguish, you will immediately distinguish in these kinds of talks. And especially now that you can follow day by day and read the talks of Abdu'l-Bahá for each day in the year that's coming up when he's will have been traveling across America. So it gives you a nice prompting, you know. Let's see what Abdu'l-Bahá said today 100 years ago. I think even the public is going to become interested in some of that. Their websites are being created so we can find these things and hear the news of what Abdu'l-Bahá did while he was here in America. But when he was in Haifa, Shoghi Effendi was not yet a hand of the cause. He was one of the first Africans that came. And he was a knight of Baha'u'llah. And he said, you know, I came to the presence of the guardian. I was nervous. I had glasses. I didn't like wearing glasses in the presence of the guardian. It felt intrusive, so I took the glasses off. And he said, my eyesight improved while I was in Haifa, actually. And he said, Shoghi Effendi talked to me about all things. And he said that he put me in the Eastern Pilgrim House up near the Shrine of the Bab. There were no Eastern Pilgrims. Lotfullah Hakim was there with me, he said, who was later to be a member of the House, the First House of Justice. And Lotfullah took care of him, arranged for his meals, had the meals brought up from the served him and so on. And he said that it was the custom of the guardian when there were pilgrims in the Eastern Pilgrim House to come to the shrine area to visit with the pilgrims in the afternoon and walk with them to the shrines and talk to them there and recite the tablet of visitation in one of the shrines and then come back. So Mr. Olinga had this privilege of visiting with the guardian every afternoon during his pilgrimage. But he said to me, come to the house of the master in the morning. And he spent several hours every day in the morning talking to me and teaching me. He said, it was such an experience. And he said, you must master Abdu'l-Bahá's speaking style. You must study and see how it is, and you must make that your own so that you can speak like the master and in a similar manner. And that was the thing that I saw when he was huddled with groups of Baha'is. He spoke on these most intimate subjects about the soul and spiritual progress. When he was in the public, he had these very dignified, beautiful presentations. I've seen him speak to, previously I'd seen him speak in a hall of 500 people in Panama City. And so many people, they're just impressed with him. And when he was moving around in these towns on this trip and cities, oftentimes crowds would accumulate around him just spontaneously. You know, Abdu'l-Bahá, he says that if you're truly faithful to the covenant and so on, when you enter a town, you'll magnetize the people and they will come out. I saw that with my own eyes with the Inokolinga in Latin America. And people said, who is he? He's a king. He's an African king. People would keep coming, asking about that. They all got the idea. It was just so kingly, the way he held himself. But he was also humble and accessible. I can see him in one of the towns between Quito and Esmeraldas. We stopped at a bus stop, and we were going to stay overnight there. And some of the Baha'is came out of the bus with him. We were standing in the streets, and pretty soon a crowd gathered around him. He had about 8 to 10 children, one on each of his hands, and he was walking down, laughing, walking down the center of the street. And people were accumulating behind him, and we walked several blocks with this parade of several hundred people. Everybody asking, who is he, and where has he come from, and so on. It was beautiful testimony to that. We got to Esmeraldas, which is a little fishing town down on the coast, also has a lot of black population. And we had arrived a bit early. We were staying in a house that was near the wharfs and the river district there. And the Baha'is were going to come to a meeting later. He said, let's go for a walk. And we started walking. I followed him. We heard some really very strong syncopated music coming out of a set of buildings with bridges between them. You know, it was like a shanty town. But we went in there and we found there was a bar and the music playing and people were dancing. And Mr. Olinga said, let's go dance. That's that spontaneous. The Baha'is don't know this, you know, you're the first one. I was a little straight-laced, but the hand of the cause is saying, let's dance. I said, okay, then I've got permission, I can do that.
Who left?
Who left?
Who led?
Who led? Oh, we didn't dance together. It was one of those things, you know, where everybody's moving around. Nobody holds on to anybody except someone. That was good. So we did that for a while. And then we came out and we met the Baha'is and we had a big meeting. And that was wonderful. In Peru, we had a nice meeting in Lima. And then we went to the highlands, to Cusco, which is quite a high altitude, and had its own Baha'i community up there, and quite a different culture from the coast. And it was near Lake Titicaca, which is one of the large lakes in the world. Anyway, we visited around there, and then the Baha'is took us to meet a radio commentator, announcer. This guy was very enthusiastic, and he met Mr. Ling and was impressed with him and started asking him all kinds of questions. Mr. Ling had a spontaneous sense of humor. He would start laughing. One would have to be a little cautious because he would laugh himself to the fainting stage. A number of times I've been in a restaurant situation where something struck him funny over dinner. We were there with some of the friends and so on. He'd start laughing. And then pretty soon everybody at the table is laughing. And pretty soon all the people at the other tables are laughing too. Nobody knows what they're laughing about except they're laughing and enjoying the laughing. It's just that kind of contagious, spontaneous fun. And this man was taken with Mr. Olinga's name. So when he announced him on the radio, he said, we're so happy here. We're in the presence of Enoch Olinga. Mr. Olinga would begin howling laughter about this funny. So we got him calmed down, and we got on with the interview and got the translation of the interview in a way. Okay. So now, after several months, we had to say goodbye in Colombia because he was going into the zone of the other counselors. And I said, I didn't. He said, come with me. I said, I think I better not go there. You better let the counselors there take you around. So I turned around from Colombia, and he went on. And later, when he was in the Caribbean islands, he wrote me a letter. Well, it was a kind letter of appreciation. Thank you for coming, and what a nuisance and all that stuff. But the beginning of the letter says, Dear Hooper. And that letter is going to be there in history, and people are going to look at it and say, what in the world? Why does Hooper have 16 O's in it? You know, lots of fun. So he was one of the hands that came there, and then we met him again in South America. And he, you know, they had a tradition, just to be warned, any of you who are black that might go to South America, in both Bolivia and Chile, they believe it's good luck to pinch a black man. Hooper, get me out of here, they're killing me. This crowd of 300 people jammed in, all of them wanting to get their good luck, you know? Poor man. Fortunately, being dark, you couldn't see all of the bruises that he had after that. But we learned to not get him out in open public like that anymore. There was a talk that he gave. 400 people in a small little theater in southern Chile in a village setting. And these people just screamed the whole time. Most of them had never seen anybody from Africa, so that was already exciting. And after he got finished saying, Jumbo, Jumbo, they were all crazy, excited. And I don't know if any of them, some of them become Baha'is, some of them are in that area, were attracted to the faith already. But he had his exciting moments with those populations. And in distant places in Bolivia, too, we took him. The Baha'is had heard that he's from the Holy Land and come there with the blessings of the hands and the House of Justice. And they arranged these marvelous meetings. We walked up a dry riverbed and we came. And here were like 50 yards of children holding green palm, and not palms, but green leaves that were tied at the top, making archway for him to walk in under the archway up to the village. Where they got the greens from, none of us could figure out. Or they'd gone from miles away to bring them. And then we were all there up, perched up on the side of a hillside. And the particular kinds of singing of these people are something like Chinese a cappella choirs with screechy high voices, and then every once in a while you hear Baha'i in the middle, Baha'i in the middle of the songs. And it was most charming, and we had a terrific feast of armadillo steaks, and I don't know, it was a unique occasion. There were about 200 Baha'is there from these distant tribes in Chuquisaca. For those of you that know Bolivia, it's was really remote backcountry. That's one of the most remote places I ever went in Bolivia. And believe me, I've been to some remote places in Bolivia, including the Beni and the Pando, these distant Amazon territories, which we helped to open to the faith with groups of Baha'is. And then we opened Acre, behind there, which was nice to talk to the people there and say that, you know, your place is named after the one in the Holy Land, and the one in the Holy Land has this significance, and it was a perfect opening for the faith. Then also Mr. Featherstone came for the formation of the NSA of Bolivia, and he also came to the coast and came to Bluefields and visited with us. And by that time, there were more pioneers in the area. A few pioneers were there, and we were able to host him, and he spoke to the people on that occasion. That was marvelous. And then after that, Marilyn and I were married, and we were on the coast, and Mr. Fazy came from South America, and he wanted to meet us, so we came to Managua, to the capital, by plane, not on foot and overland like sometimes, but we flew over there, and we met him, and that was a wonderful occasion, and he spoke with the Baha'is so lovingly, and he'd been busy battling covenant breakers in South America, poor man. Was kind of tired and fatigued and on his way home. But he was so kind, he came through Central America too. Who else? Any am I missing? The Hands in the Holy Land, yeah, that's of course later on. But of those ones that came through Central America, yeah. Dr. Mohajir, there, memorable visit. He was in South America. He came there. He went out with us to some villages. One of the villages, they all became Baha'is. And he spoke in such simple terms of the faith, showed us really how we could do it, you know. And he was the first one that kind of relieved us and said, you know, you don't have to study the will and testament of these illiterate people before they become believers. You can bring them in and gradually inform them of the covenant. I was trying to figure out, how do you read the will and testament with them? Because that was the formula we had in the States before we went there. You know, you'd read the New Era and the Dispensation and the Will and Testament of Abdu'l-Baha, okay? Those were required readings before you could declare yourself. So and they wanted to know who you studied it with to be sure you understood what you were doing. This is not a social club, young man. This is a serious religion. I almost didn't make it in. It was a close. Then the convention, the international convention, and there was nobody going from Nicaragua, so my mother-in-law, a Baha'i pioneer in Honduras, and my non-Baha'i mother backed me financially so I could go to this convention. Blessings on your mom. She really did that. She never quite made it to the faith, but she made it pretty close. She liked a lot of the Baha'is, and she came to the Holy Land and played golf with Ali Nakhchivani and Paul Haney, and she really enjoyed them. She said they were so kind to her. But she never quite made it through to the Baha'i teachings. I don't know. She used to say, when I first became a Baha'i, you and Bula Hula. When she'd introduce me to her friend, she'd say, he's joined some kind of Persian love cult. I don't know what it is. But she said he's been in lots of things. It's a phase. I'm sure it'll pass. How did I hear about the faith? From another Baha'i. I heard about the faith from a Baha'i who had been in Europe, was from a Czech-Hungarian family hung together, who was coming of age about 17 at the beginning of the Second World War, of Jewish extraction. And his relatives all contributed together and sent him to New York. And they all went to the gas chambers. And he's the only one that didn't. And he was blessed with finding the faith. His name was Sandel Berger. He died as a pioneer eventually in Pueblo, Mexico, some years ago. And he's the first one that I was very attracted to and who spoke to me. He was a sculptor and a painter as well. It was interesting. And he had an influence on a whole group of us that went out different places. Shirley Macias, did some of you know Shirley Macias? She's in Desert Rose still. She came in at that same time. And Seymour Malcolm, who became an auxiliary board member in South America and in Brazil and passed away there, also was in that immediate group of friends of Sandoz. Then it was a deepening experience with other Baha'is, some wonderful teachers that we had. We both had. We're both coming close to the faith about the same time, Marilyn and I. And let's see, then 63, so I went to the Holy Land. So the Holy Land, the hands of the cause had decided they would stay out of sight, that they wouldn't greet any delegates before the election, so that nobody could say anything. They had asked that the Baha'is not vote for them, they leave them free to do the services that they should do as hands of the cause, but they could only ask that, they couldn't rule it. So they remained eligible. And I remember not intending, but sitting in my chair in the convention, noticing that the fellow next to me had written a ballot full of all the hands of the cause. I thought, oh my God, they've told us not to do that and asked us not to do that. So I thought, well, what's going to happen here? So we're in that voting session, which took place, as Chad was mentioning the first evening here, in the house of the master, and we all came there, and there were no hands in sight. They were in a room next to it to watch the convention, but you couldn't approach them at that point. And then Ruhia Khanum was the chairman of the convention, and she called on two women to recite prayers before the voting took place and to explain the voting procedures and so on. So there were no men to be singled out in any way at the beginning of that session. It was very nicely handled. And after that, we had a chance then to meet the hands of the cause. And I remember someone, I don't know, I can't remember who it was, one of the people serving in the World Center, came through this aisle and came and found me in the middle of the ends for Nicaragua, and we were all seated by alphabetical order of the assemblies, and called me out and brought me out in the middle of the proceedings, I don't know, the balloting, I guess, was going on, and brought me over and pushed me into the crowd of the hands of the cause. There were all of them there, and they started embracing me, and I said, what the heck is going on here? And after everybody had a good hug, I was in the back then with Mr. Baluzzi, and he said, sorry to disturb you, but we wanted to ask you to be a reader at the Most Great Jubilee this afternoon at the Shrine of Baha'u'llah. they had heard from Mrs. Walcott, who was there serving, that I was a good reader, I was an actor, I'd had a Hollywood background, and it would be good if I read at this Jubilee. So somehow I got involved in that. And then I understood why I'd been pushed over there. But at the first, I said, what is going on, you know? Tests that you have. It was a wonderful test, but... So in the afternoon after the elections, we all went. The tellers were appointed, and the rest of us all went to Bhaji for the Most Great Jubilee. Actually, the tellers came too, but they came back immediately, and they worked all night to bring us the results of the election of the first Universal House of Justice. Thrilling, thrilling day it was indeed. And at that time, I got to shake hands with Mr. Simandri, whose hand had been in the hand of Baha'u'llah. You think how close we still are in this at that time. And to meet all the other hands that I hadn't met. The only hand that wasn't there was Corinne True, who passed away, I think, shortly after, or had already passed away, I can't remember. But she was unable to come. And Mr. Furtan, of course, was there. Yes, I hadn't met him previously, but I met him then. And then, of course, I served for 10 years with him on the teaching center. So, yeah. Mr. Fazi would start saying something interesting in Persian, and then Mr. Furtan would say to him, Nagakon, Farsi Mikone. He would warn him that I understood some Persian, be careful what you say. Those were amazing days. That was, of course, in 1973, 10 years after the election of the House of Justice, after being a counselor in the Americas, was called to the Holy Land to serve in this first International Teaching Center with the Hands of the Cause. And all the Hands of the Cause were members of the Teaching Center, but the core members were the Hands in the Holy Land, which was Amitul Baha, Ruhi Akhanom, and Mr. Furtan, Mr. Fazi, and Mr. Haney. And we worked very closely with them, handling the correspondence as liaisons between the counselors in the world, the boards of counselors in the world, and the Universal House of Justice, and back and forth, and quite interesting. It wasn't very long before the hands rebelled and said, we don't want our letters going through the hands in the Holy Land anymore. And the House agreed that the hands in the continents throughout the world, they could directly address the House of Justice itself. And at that time, they made the hands, all world hands, international dignitaries of the faith. So they weren't any longer just for the assignment of their continent, but were all over and visited so many places and uplifted their friends so much. And that was just after that that Ruhi Akhanom decided to make her green light expedition, where she went into so many of the distant areas of South America. At some great suffering too. And as you've seen perhaps the film, and if you haven't, you should see it. She said, after this, there's no woman that can say she can't go do these things. If I can go and do them, certainly all the rest of the Baha'i women can do it. And that was one of the reasons she had for doing it. And of course, instead of that, we just marvel at her, you know. Okay. Please.
Wondering if you've ever written an autobiography, and if you haven't, will you?
Ruhi Akhanom used to ask me, are you keeping a diary, Hooper? I said, no, Akhanom. A couple of months later, are you keeping a diary, Hooper? No, Akhanom, I'm not keeping a diary. She asked me a third time. I said, Akhanom, is hard enough living it without writing it down? And she didn't ask any more after that. And I haven't written anything. So... No, these are things, some things, you know, the hands in the conclaves, they had a rule that they wouldn't take notes out and they wouldn't write anything about the conclave. They were private consultations of the hands deciding the future of the cause. This is before the House of Justice was formed. And they continued that afterwards. And they used to meet upstairs in the mansion, and then they had a disposal. As they were going out, they'd tear up their notes and throw them in there and not keep them, so that the whole experience would be one of unity, because the hands were great personalities and they could have differing opinions, you know. So sometimes something would leak out a little here and there. Mason Rumi said, if you look for a guardian, I'm sure you'll find a guardian. That's an old man, you know. Mr. Simandri says, can you show us how to make a tiger out of paper? That was the year Mason Rumi left and went out of the Holy Land. Yeah, tigers out of paper, not possible. Yes, please.
Could you please share a couple of your reflections on the recent message from the Universal House of Justice?
Yes, that's a whole, really a subject in itself. I could just say that I think that it's, that there are quite a few interesting innovations in those messages, particularly the December message. We see the reappearance of references to the local assembly and its responsibilities that hadn't been mentioned for some time. We also see that they are not saying intensive programs of growth, they're saying programs of growth. These programs of growth are no longer limited to A-level clusters. There's nothing about A, B, C, D clusters. There's clusters, and wherever the processes of the plan are sufficient, they should be having programs of growth. And they're hoping that in the course of the plan, there'll be 5,000 of such programs. And the House of Justice, I think, very beautifully and faithfully connected the past with the present and showed the necessity of why we were going in the direction we were going. You know, the enrollment stopped in the 90s. Way back, they dropped way back, and great numbers of Baha'is had to be taken off the list because there was no consolidation of the previous mass teaching that was effective. And this drove the House to have to consider very carefully what measures could be instituted to assure that we moved again towards mass teaching, that we had a much broader base of manpower, that the Baha'is didn't excuse themselves from teaching because I'm not a public speaker or I'm not a this, you know, a muck-a-muck Baha'i or something. We just, everyone had to, there was a kind of equalization. Everyone can speak about the faith in some degree, and they should prepare themselves with the Ruhi courses to do so. And you see that that's happened. I mentioned earlier here that those of us that said, well, you know, I know all the Ruhi course material. I don't know why I should study it. I'm not going to study that. And the House of Justice said, okay, you can sit on the sidelines, but don't become an obstacle. You know, don't criticize. This is the House of Justice is moving this. Help it move forward. And as it moves forward, we see the wisdom of it. And I think that the Baha'is that have gotten into it, that knew the teachings quite well, have been pleased with how they felt when they participated in the Ruhi courses. I hope you'll all embrace these if you haven't yet and go through this so you'll understand what the new Baha'is are going through and you'll have a better reciprocity between the older friends and the ones that are now coming to activities through the programs of the plan, through the activities, the core activities of the plan. Yes?
Mr. Gilmore, you mentioned Dr. Saidi and Brooke, and he has opened up a whole list about the writings of the Bible and the different levels of looking at them and all of that. Two questions. Do you think that this methodology that the Bible is opening up is some kind of instruction for us or approach the writings of Baha'u'llah? And second question, do you know if there's what the plans are to release more of the writings? Is the House of Justice planning to release more books?
You know that Nader Saidi was doing translations for the House of Justice of the Bab's writings early on. And the House of Justice at one point suggested to him that he might wish to put together a draft volume of a second volume of teachings of the Bab for submission to the House to see what it looked like. And he did this. And the House of Justice found that it wasn't timely to publish that volume in that format because it didn't have anything to do with the present activities and where we were going in the cause. But it also saw the value of having a greater vision of the writings of the Bab and encouraged him to write an academic book from his university kind of position where he could draw on all the translations of all these things that he had had been working on and set forth a picture of the writings of the Bab and the approach of the Bab in his teachings. And then he did that, and that was gradually, he edited it and it came into the present form of the Gate of the Heart. So from up to where I was on the House of Justice, there were no immediate plans to publish more writings of the Bab. That book in itself is a terrific, you can spend the rest of your life trying to digest that. Also, you realize the emphasis in the Bab's writings, and certainly the Bab's writings and Baha'u'llah's writings are complementary and a continuum, you know. Baha'u'llah refers to the Bab as my own previous manifestation. His identity is the same as the Bab's at the inner level. And so those writings are as much a part of the Baha'i dispensation as Baha'u'llah's. They are related, of course, to the continuum of the Shia milieu and understanding that the Persians had of the faith of Islam. And our emphasis is metaphysical in character, where Baha'u'llah's emphasis, not metaphysical, but the emphasis is more social. And I think, this is my own take on this, my own understanding is that the writings of the Bab will flow into the Baha'i community as the Baha'is mature and as they accomplish the social goals of the faith. There will be more time to meditate on these things. In the meanwhile, we have a foretaste, a bit of some of these terrific, mysterious elements that the Bab has included in his writings. Yes?
No, I wonder if you could share with us a couple of thoughts on friends in Iran, especially those who are in jail.
Yes, I wish I could do justice to that. The Yaran have been suffering. The Yaran would write us all the time. They'd write us love letters to the House of Justice. And they'd say, don't worry about us. You do what you want with the cause, but don't worry about it. Don't try to get us out of prison. We're doing fine here. And this is part of our sacrifice, so to speak, which isn't a sacrifice. They said, really, it's just complete joy to be doing what we're doing. And they had such an influence on the other prisoners that were around them in that original prison where they were surrounded by political prisoners. And now where they've been moved to really a criminal prison where they have, you know, murderers and rapists and all kinds of other difficult people around them. And where they're also doing a transforming job, especially the women are becoming renowned for the influence that they have on these other prisoners. Calmed the whole prison down and got people praying and thinking about spiritual matters. These people were desperate criminals that had no future at all. And seeing these Baha'i women has had such an impact on them. And it's so touching to hear the stories. I guess you've heard some of the stories, no doubt, of how they've just given up their own lives. They're there to be instruments of Baha'u'llah. And in my own take, and I think, you know, certainly among the House members, we haven't quite written it that way, but the transformation that's taken place in the non-Baha'i Iranian population is the result of these people's sacrifice. It's some years now they're there, and the publicity that came out about them and the stories that transcend through the prison guards who were also enamored of them, you know. So they loved them so much, they liked them so much, the influence, the kindness that they were shown and so on. This happened, of course, during the early days of the revolution too, you know. One of the counselors was a doctor, and he was in prison there in Tehran, and he was treating the families of the guards and of the prison officials and things. And when the order came to kill him, they said they rebelled. They said, "No, you can't. You know, we need him. He's the one that calms down the other people when we want to shoot them. They're so nervous and upset. We can't make them walk or stand up or anything. We send." Gosh, his name has gone out of my head. What's his name? Come on. Dr. Farhangi. We send Dr. Farhangi to talk to them. And he goes to some general who's completely all shaken up, and he sits there with him for 10, 15 minutes and talks about the other world and talks about the station of man, talks about his integrity, and the general stands up like a general and he goes out and takes the bullets. They said, that's the influence of him. We can't lose this. And they said, no, no, his time has come. And he gave sweets to the ones who were to shoot him, and he said, please, all of you, aim at my heart. I want my heart to receive your bullets. And they started crying, and some of them begged him to forgive them. He said, don't do that. This is your job. This is your responsibility. And he gave them sweets, all of them. And that night, two of them went to Mrs. Farhangi's house, where there was a quasi-meeting after the day of the execution, and banged on the door, and they opened the door, and here's two of the Revolutionary Guards, and they're saying, what do you want? You're going to go on making this family suffer? And they said, no, we want to see Mrs. Farhangi. So they brought them in, and they fell on their faces before him and begged forgiveness of her for what they'd been involved in, until she could forgive them and say, don't worry, you did it as part of your job, and so on. And Dr. Farhangi had told her 2 weeks before, he said, you know, a couple of Mo'avin, of the auxiliary board members, are already gone to the other side. He said, they have no counselor to direct them. I think my time is coming short. So she had some idea this thing was coming. But that's just the kind of spirit that they have. I mean, Baha'u'llah, their spirits transcend the difficulties that they face. And through those kinds of stories and things, a new spirit prevailed in Iran amongst the non-Baha'is. Not all of them, obviously, it's still the fanatics and everything else, but the mass doesn't buy the story of who the Baha'is are and that they have sex parties and that they do all these things. They realize they've been sold a bill of goods. And in the electoral revolution after the voting, you know, took place last year, there were placards, non-Baha'is carrying placards, free the Baha'is. We've never seen anything like that in Iran. And there were all kinds of mentions that the people didn't believe what was being said about the Baha'is. Now, in the meanwhile, the House of Justice initiated a series of messages to the Baha'is of Iran, which really are messages to be read over the shoulder of the Baha'is by the general public, so that those messages have gone all around, and they praise the culture and traditions of Iran and hope for its best future and things like that. And I think that's definitely had its impact. I mean, this is under the guidance of Baha'u'llah that they've been doing this, and now it's happened also in Egypt. Those of you who've seen the message of the Baha'is of Egypt to the Egyptian people. There's a new wind blowing in the Middle East, definitely. And this, I can't see how this change would have taken place except through the suffering of these Yaran. It was during this period you realize that Iranian intellectuals in the West wrote this terrific statement, we are ashamed of the history of the faith, of what has happened to you people, and we ask your forgiveness. Signed by, I don't know, how many people? It was a couple hundred, I think, of these outstanding. So that also circulated in the blood of those people who were out, understand, and people inside Iran wanted to understand. All kinds of interesting things happen like that. One thing I wanted to mention is that one of the groups of literary mullahs in Qom publish monthly various Islamic writings and publications of interest to other Muslims. And they published this very interesting treatise, which they said was anonymous, called The Seven Valleys. When it was all out everywhere before they realized somebody told them, this is Baha'u'llah's writings. Who else? Somebody else was there. Yes, please.
I'm wondering if you could give us a few words about maybe bridging your book with the letter to the Egyptians, Egyptian NSA's letter to the Egyptians recently.
Yeah, I never thought about bridging those two at all, so I don't know what... what I could tell you. How about you could probably try that yourself? See what you come up with. I'm really not, I hadn't thought of that at all. It's just part of the whole question of the forces of, that I, as I think I mentioned yesterday, the question of these young people, for the most part, have another vision now. And they want to their country to be a reflection of the will of the people. This is what's happening there, and this is something Baha'u'llah has said would happen. That it passes from tyrannical leaders to the masses of the people. So I think we can expect to see more of that. Although, as it happens, this happened in Iran, but then the clergy took advantage of it and consolidated their control of everything. And I think you can begin to see some of the signs of that perhaps happening with Egypt. We don't know how it's going to be, and also with Yemen, and certainly the Bahrain. And I just it's hard, it's too early to tell where it's going to go, but I don't think you're going to calm this new generation down. They have the taste of freedom, they have a taste of vision themselves. Thank you very much. Okay, one more question, then we have to stop. I think we're over the hour here. Sorry.
I just wondered, is there an attempt to compile these beautiful stories of guardian of different people that have met him and seen this, they're getting older in life and perhaps maybe passing on soon? A collection of maybe some of their reflections and stories of being in his presence?
Well, I think some of it has been recorded in some of the biographies about the Hands of the Cause. And that generation, you have to look and collect them now. We're losing the people that had met Chogi Effendi. It's a worthy goal, but we do have some. And we have these, as I said, we have paragraphs, quite a bit more about the manifestation of God himself now than we ever had in past dispensations. And service, that's the question. It should result in sacrifice and service. We should emulate these, those that have gone before. We're standing on their shoulders. We're where we are in the cause because of the sacrifices they have made and the offering of their lives. Basically, we've got this life and we have nothing else. We can spend it. That's where our free will comes in. The Bab says, you know, you have free will. It's been given you by God to choose God's ways. Any other use of that power is illicit. It's not given you to choose other things. It's given you to choose him. So in case you have some plan to choose something else, better think about it twice. Thank you. Good night.